Well, hello, and a very warm welcome back to the Andrew Eborn Show. It's my favourite part of the show, Andrew Eborn's Greatest Writs. And the favourite part of that is a pair of briefs joined by none other than the brilliant Stephen Barrett, who always comes up with a wonderfully amusing response to the question, the British question, how are you, Stephen?
I'm well because I have fed my child. So that is always good, because if you know your child is downstairs eating hot food, protein and vegetables, you are generally in a better mood.
And it's a wonderful move. And we see your mood change, not only your child, but your beast as well.
Yes, the great beast has gone to bed.
I have to say the great beast is a wonderful beagle called Bella. Bella the Beagle, who's made previous appearances on the Andrew Eborn Show. We love the people and their pets. This is a great thing.
Just
that we should
check
look at.
On the beast.
Oh, no, go get the beast. So we love it when you go and get the beast, because it's a really exciting stuff. And that's what we love about this sort of stuff. Is she coming?
No, she's asleep.
No, I understand. Don't let sleeping dogs lie.
Yeah, she's a great sleeper. My dad always jokes that she must be a cat.
Ah, wonderful. We should talk about animal rights and things like that. What rights do animals have?
Very little, unless given them by statute, because the traditional position in England is that they don't have much rights at all. The earliest known, and I hope listeners and viewers know that I had no idea you were going to ask this, but the earliest known...
I've sent you some big briefing notes on this one.
The earliest known laws are on the entitlements of the king. So the first time you really get sort of animals referencing is the king's right to things like whales on the foreshore. The one that everybody knows is the king's right to swans.
But so it's only a certain type of swan, isn't it? It's a mute swan.
Well, it was the only type we had then. So there's an argument, but I don't think His Majesty's terribly litigious. So I think it's fine.
Well, they have the swan upping, don't they? Which is a glorious thing. It's where people have to go and count the swans and that sort of stuff.
Yes, and it's but there are. I'm trying to think of other animals to which the king had automatic rights. I think the king has rights to verdigris. In 1215. The chronicler Matthew Paris, not the one who's still around today with the lovely voice, but the then Matthew Paris, noted that all of the herring caught by the fleets in Scarborough rotted in the harbour because the Swedes and the Norwegians, who we normally sold our herring to, had stayed home because they were worried about the Mongols. I'm trying to think of other references to animals. You start to get legal rights to cattle grazing.
Yes.
And then we get the common law rights to cattle grazing and the common land. And then after the common land, the enclosures, which is the suppression of common land. But near where I am, there are a few woods, what are now woods, that were used to be common grazing land. And obviously, the land is pretty rubbish, which is why it's now a wood. So although it sounded really great, the common man always got the nasty end of the stick, not the good one. But yes, the idea of animals having rights is a relatively modern idea. I'd be so bold as to risk the idea it's 20th century, at which point I'm probably almost certainly wrong, and we'll discover that the RSPB was set up in 1890 or something. But the idea of protecting animals is relatively new. And the other one I always like to point out is that when people assume that when Darwin published, everyone was very upset because it sort of somehow challenged God. But the view amongst the Anglican church, which is what we were, almost all of us were Anglicans back then, was that it didn't challenge God in any way, and that evolution was perfectly consistent, natural selection was perfectly consistent with God's plan. It just means that it's all a metaphor, which is tends to be the Anglican go-to. So they didn't really think it meant that there was no such thing as God, but they were very upset, and vicars gave sermons because they were terribly upset at the idea that all of the animals didn't sort of live in harmony and sing Kumbaya Because that was the general, generally that's like the Who Killed Cock Robin thing,
Oh
you know.
no, we love all that. Well, I can tell you the RSPB was set up in 1889.
Oh, I knew it would be
There you go.
1889.
We love it. It's got to be good. But what I also love, so other thing people do is they leave things in their wills for their animals. How does that work?
Yes, well, it doesn't really. It's a very dangerous road to go down. We'd much rather that people left things in their money in their wills for animal charities. Trying to leave it for an animal is almost impossible because the animal has no right to hold property. And that's the big problem. If people do, I mean, if you went to a professional solicitor, they would guide you through the process and make sure you didn't make a mistake. But I do worry about the people who go to W.H. Smith and, you know, get a make your own will kit, and then sort of just think that they can do
I
whatever they
leave it all
like.
to Bella the Beagle.
Well, Bella cannot hold property. Bella is property. That's
Yes.
the other one to point out, is that all animals are viewed as property. And I can't remember which government it was now, but one of the governments wanted to make a specific crime about stealing pets because we all got pets during lockdown and then people started nicking them. And some of the cynical lawyers who didn't like the lefty lawyers who don't like the Conservative Party were like, this is a stupid idea, stupid idea. We don't need a specific offence. It's already theft to steal an animal. It's like, yes, it is. But because of our heartless legal system, it's theft to the value of that animal.
Yes.
And a family, I mean, one of the most things I'm most proud of in the media is that when our cat died, in a scandal involving poisonous pet food, I was able to get across, you know, in a variety of medium that these are family members. And they're not, you know, Bella is not worth her monetary cost.
No.
You know, and my cat Freya
And
was
we've
not.
often spoken about how heartless the legal system feels when you go to Kemp or whatever it is and say, this is the value of an arm or a leg or whatever. It's got a financial value. It's even worse for pets, as you say, because they are family members and things like that. And rightly, well, I talked about the RSPB. Well, the RSPCA was set up a bit earlier than that. I think it was 1824 on the Strand in London. So they've had rights. The other interesting thing, which people may not know, is these pacemakers. And a lot of people, when they're a second-hand pacemaker, you can leave it to your dog.
Have you?
Yes.
It sounds obscure and weird.
No, but if your dog needs a pacemaker and you have one, you can leave it to them. Anyway, it's all good stuff. I'm talking about returning things because this is what happens, and that's the most non sequitur link I think we've ever done. We were talking about the Elgin Marbles, and we said we were going to unpack this and what the legal issues are and the historical context. The Elgin Marbles, also known as people will know as the Parthenon Marbles, it involves complex legal, ethical, and cultural considerations. Let's have a look at the history. Let's have a look at the rights and wrongs. Because some argue that Lord Elgin, it's named after him, his removal of the marbles was illegal even under the laws at the time. Talk us through it, Stephen.
That's what we call tosh, Andrew, just to be clear. And these are in no way complicated legal, moral, or ethical questions. They are settled legal questions. What they are is the obsession of a certain group of people. And that's, there is no reason at all to look at the Elgin Marbles differently from the Rosetta Stone. Why would you? And you know, the Met Museum in New York, it's got an awful lot of Egyptian prehistory in it. How'd it get there? This is perfectly normal. This is what happens. But there is a particular obsession with, firstly, disliking this country. And this is where the Chagos Islands issue comes from. And proving that you are morally virtuous by doing things that harm your country. And because the Elgin Marbles are the pride of the British Museum. Although, I mean, I'd argue the Rosetta Stone is now, or in my view, there's a beautiful cameo of the Emperor Augustus.
Yes.
It's about this big, and it's on the first floor, and that is really stunning. And actually, there's a gold cape, which was found in Wales, but probably used for religious purposes, which again is absolutely stunning. There's a lot of good stuff in the British Museums, but because the sort of one that people made a fuss about, the one that's got its own room, the one that, you know, people go on and on about is the Elgin Marbles. Just whilst we're on the British Museum, I always like to point out that there are these things called the Seven Wonders of the Ancient World, of which the Parthenon is not one. So it's not one. But we've got one in the British Museum. We've got all the original bits of it, and then we created it. And it's the, I think it's the temple, oh no, it's the Mausoleum of Halicarnassus. That's it. Which is one of the original seven mentioned by the historian Herodotus as one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. And we have the Mausoleum of Halicarnassus in the British Museum, and hardly anybody ever goes and sees it because it's in a really back corner. The bit that always looks like the 60s. I don't know why. They've got like 60s tiles on the floor, and it's just very. But anyway, we've literally got a wonder of the ancient world. No one mentions it. Everyone obsesses about the Elgin Marbles because, you know, reasons. And the other thing we should say about the Elgin Marbles is that they. The lunatics who like to control our language and thought, the authoritarians, have decided that we must call them the Parthenon marbles.
Yes.
Therefore, I consider it an act of rebellion that I always refer to them as the Elgin
Well,
marbles.
they would say, and I always like to put the arguments for the police devil's advocate, that it was stolen by Elgin, they would say, and they the Parthenon, because that's where they came from.
Well, what's wrong with even if they were stolen by Elgin,
The Robin
which
Hood
they weren't.
marbles.
Exactly. Why would you? It's like, do we look at the Italian job and refer that to the gold that was taken in the Italian? Would it
Well,
say what?
now that Trump's renaming everything, I think it could apply. But let's look at the argument, because this is what I love about it, is rather than just dismiss the whole thing. So scholars like Catherine Tite, do you know her?
No,
So she
she must know
asserts that the
something
appropriation
random.
was not legally sanctioned by the Ottoman Empire and suggests that bribes were used to facilitate the removal.
I don't think that's right because I'm pretty sure that he was very highly thought of within the administration. And basically, what you get at that time, and the Ottomans were used, they used it late, either at the same time or later as an ammunition dump.
Yes,
They didn't
yes.
value it on any level. Of course, it's sacrilegious to them. As far as they're concerned, you know, they are Muslims, they're Sunni Muslims. You shouldn't be depicting the human form at all. So you know that they were more moderate than the Taliban because the Taliban would have just blown it all up. I mean, that's what when the Taliban got control of Afghanistan and there's a large ancient Buddhist statue of a human being, they blow it up because it's sacrilegious to depict the human form. These are depictions of the human form. They are not going to rate them on any level. The idea that in fact, it's probably terribly decent of the Ottomans that they didn't blow them up. But they did use it as an ammunition dump, and there was an accident after Elgin had taken the marbles. So, had the marbles remained upon the Parthenon, they almost certainly would have been destroyed. And that's from that event, but also wear and tear over time. What you have to remember, what I didn't know about limestone, but it becomes obvious once you sort of think it through, is that it does actually dissolve in water because water is slightly acidic. So limestone will dissolve. That's where stalagmites and stalactites come from. So
Yes.
the limestone's in the water, then the water evaporates, and then it leaves behind the stalactite or the stalagmite, and you get sinkholes in chalk area for a very similar reason. There are outside the Sheldonian Theatre in Oxford, which is not often known as the Sheldonian Theatre, but that building that has the massive heads outside it for reasons no one understands. There are loads of columns with giant heads on. Those heads have to be replaced every 300 years.
No,
And
absolutely. The Limestone Cowboys, that's what they're called.
and the last time they were replaced, some of them are now in people's like garden in Oxford. It's
Yes.
just sort of like terribly, like a really old snowman that's just sort of completely degraded. So the idea that you could have left them out and that they'd be absolutely fine now is complete
Well,
rubbish.
what Catherine Tite says is that the argument hinges on the interpretation that the firmans, the decrees that Elgin received, did not permit the extensive removal he undertook. So the removal was illegal. That's what she argues.
Well, that's not an argument because she hasn't quoted them. So if she wants to argue that, she can tell me what the quote is and then we can listen and we can all decide whether that's true or not. We can use rational logic in law. We're not tied into just interpreting text. If Lord Elgin was acting illegally, why didn't they complain?
No, I think that's one argument. There's all sorts of reasons they may not have done. They might not have said, well, who do we complain to? Doesn't necessarily mean just because we didn't make a noise about it, didn't make it legal on that sort of basis.
They're our
But
ally. No, we've got to remember this about that. And it's one another thing I'm quite proud of with us is that and Elizabeth I did this. We are the first Christian nation who goes and talks to the Ottomans at all. And engages in a trade treaty with them, a trade deal. We get it's the start of British real economic success is that we went and talked to them. The French and everybody else, the Holy Roman Empire, which is Germany, everybody else was like, they're heathens, they're Saracens, they're demons, you can't talk to them. And we were just like, we're going to see if we can trade with them. Let's go. And off we jolly well popped, and we got on with them. So they've been our allies for a very long time by the time of Lord Elgin. And they liked us, and we got on in a ridiculous level. They're probably our first Muslim friend as England or Britain. And they fall eventually. It's all the bad stuff during the First World War. They basically end up on the wrong side. But it's a relationship of mutual respect for a very long time.
Yes.
And I think people miss that. The
Well, I think,
idea,
but
because
even respectful people can still steal from each other.
they can. I would say that probably by the time of Lord Elgin, we were equals. By the time of Elizabeth I, they were more powerful than we were. So it's not the type of relationship you're going to risk.
Okay.
I'm
So
not
that so that, that
sure.
that's the first thing then, is whether the original acquisition where he was entitled to do, that's what people argue on that basis. The other thing they talk about is the development of international law, particularly concerning cultural heritage. And that shifted towards recognizing the rights of countries to reclaim artifacts. And I want to refer you to the 1970 UNESCO Convention on Cultural Property. Although not directly applicable, it reflects a growing consensus on the repatriation of cultural artifacts. And customary law, as noted by some scholars, increasingly supports the return of items taken under dubious circumstances. What's your take on that?
So the first, just to make another point about the original one, is that that has been litigated, and so it is settled in law that the Elgin marbles were lawfully obtained. So that I know they keep smearing it, but it is actually
A
settled.
right to appeal? Can they bring it back? Is there any new evidence they could offer?
Well, exactly. What new evidence is there from just a few years ago? The idea that customary international law is binding is communism. And we need to fight this. And we've discussed this before. And just the communists are in international law, and they keep calling it customary international law. We've developed it. What do you mean you've developed what? What have you developed? What is developed? Can you just, what word do you mean, you absolute loons? You had no authority to create this law, but you've developed it based on a convention. I bet if you go back and read the 1970 UNESCO conservation, whatever, it just
Convention
says.
on Cultural Property.
It just says really vague things because in 1971 there was no idea that you would repatriate, so-called repatriate, i.e., nick valuable objects from museums. It's completely wrong. If things are obtained by theft, that's different, and there are all sorts of ways that we deal with objects like that. But look at this intellectually. The idea that objects belong somewhere is just nonsense. So here I wear two rings. And this ring is a modern gold replica of the Roman original. The gemstone in the middle is the original garnet from a Roman ring from 2nd century AD, what was then called Syria Palestina. It was a funerary ring, which is why I had to have the gold remade, because they were thrifty, those Romans. And if you had a funeral ring, a funerary ring, a ring that somebody was buried with, they made it basically out of gold tin foil.
Ah.
So if you try and wear it, it just basically crushes on your finger, because that they didn't want a solid gold ring just sitting in the ground. The Romans are not Egyptian, and the Romans culturally dislike the Egyptians because they see the Egyptians as very wasteful. They're like, "What are you doing, putting gold in the ground? Just put some tin foil on it; it'll be fine." So that's true. Now, does this garnet belong with me, its lawful owner? Does it belong in Israel? Does it belong in Rome? Where does it belong?
Where did you get it? How did you get it?
I got it from a legitimate antique trader near the British Museum.
And how did they get
And
it?
legitimately from a dig in Syria, Palestine. Not everything that comes out of archaeological digs is automatically state-owned. So there are quite a lot of legally owned and legally ownable historical relics, if anybody's interested in this. There are always about three or four or five or six shops near the British Museum that sell things. For my wedding, I got all of my groomsmen a Roman oil lamp because there were so many Roman oil lamps around. You know, they're reasonably priced, but they are terracotta Roman oil lamps from 100 AD or whatever. And I got my best man a Greek wine cup from the 4th century BC,
Fantastic.
which was a little bit more money. But you know, I did say could have been used by Socrates, could have been used
But
by Plato.
no, but absolutely everything could have been.
Yeah, exactly. He just came to the house one day.
Sorry,
But
and your other ring? You said you got two rings. What is that? What's the other one?
this is just a bit of lapis and silver that I got with my child, so it makes me feel
Down the old Kent Road for a fiver.
no, 45 quid in Oxford.
Oh, there you go. No, but it's good.
But
So you're right. Everything we can trace the history back, and it does raise all sorts of questions. The other argument, which is thrown out, is not necessarily the legal argument, but the moral argument. They say it's an integral part of Greek a cultural heritage, and the removal is viewed as a form of cultural appropriation. What's your take on that?
sounds a bit ethno, doesn't it? A bit ethno-cultural. It's like, what do you mean? If I start saying something's part of Anglo-Saxon heritage, I'm probably going to get a knock at the door. You know, Hitler went on an awful lot about what was part of German ethno-heritage. He was quite a bad man, just in case anybody wonders. It's a bit silly because Greece was created by the British Empire after the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, or maybe before, but anyway, we created it as a state. It hadn't existed before then. It was owned by the Ottomans. Before then, it was owned by the Byzantines. Before then, it was owned by the e Eastern Romans. Although they're culturally the same, I think you can distinguish between Byzantium and the Eastern Roman Empire. Before then, it was just owned by the Roman Empire because the Western Empire hadn't fallen. Greece never existed until Britain creates it as a cultural idea, because before Rome takes control of it, it's a bunch of city-states. And Athens and Sparta very famously have their big war. Boris Johnson likes a lot of the speeches that come out of that war from an Athenian general called Pericles. There's a nice
He
bust
loves
of
Pericles,
Pericles.
doesn't he?
He does, but there's a nice bust of Pericles also in the British Museum. Go see that. I'm just basically a tour guide for the British Museum. But so it hadn't ever culturally existed until Britain creates it as one country. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. I'm not criticizing anybody for that. England didn't exist until, you know, King Alfred decided to create the concept of England. It's not an offense. It's not being rude to anybody. Italy didn't exist until Garibaldi and the
Yes.
Garibaldi biscuits.
I know he loves his Gary. How did they come about, the Garibaldi biscuits?
Somehow the Garibaldi biscuits built a nation. I mean, that's just too complicated for us on this episode.
That's always the thing because, and that's the other point, isn't it? Because where does it stop? Because you turn around and you look around the world and say, well, hang on, that came from over there. And I got this on a little trip to wherever. And Stephen Ball gave me that because I was his best man. Where does it stop?
And it doesn't. And that's because these people are not trying to create a system of rules known in advance that they enforce f without fear or favour. They are trying to create mob rule, which is if we scream loudly enough, we will get our own way. And that lies at the heart of every authoritarian. That is what they absolutely want to happen. There is no suggestion of consistently applying this rule. I mean, the Germans have got a fantastic bust of Nefertiti. If we could argue that she came and visited us at some point, can we have
Oh, no,
that?
I think we should argue all of these. And I want us to. I want us to shine a spotlight. So when people, they all should say, no FT, no comment. What I love about these, a pair of briefs, we can give them a few facts, a few arguments. They can form their own judgment accordingly and things like that. Now, people quote, I'll probably get the name wrong, but you can help me here. Cases like the International Court of Justice ruling on the Temple of Prayer Vihear, is that how you pronounce it, have established that international jurisprudence can lean towards repatriation when artifacts are linked to cultural identity and were removed under contentious circumstances. Do you know about the ruling of the Temple of Prayer? Prayer
No, but
Vihear.
I know that that's complete rubbish as law. So what does contentious? And this is why. So I do like to inform people of the distinction between public international lawyers and private international lawyers. And basically, the public international lawyers have been slightly going off at the back of the fridge. And for years, we've just been ignoring it. And I sort of had to take them on because of Brexit.
Yes.
And if it hadn't been for Brexit, I would still be ignoring them at the back of the fridge. But they've come out as lunatics. The idea that property should pass because it is contentious is mob rule. Okay, that's all that is. The idea that, I mean, I've never seen your house, Andrew, but if I can get enough people together and we're all outraged that it's really lovely and it should be mine, then it should be mine, shouldn't it? And that's what these people really want, because they don't like individual property ownership. So they want to attack concepts of property ownership, and they want to sort of throw morality at it. Now that they've got rid of God, they sort of want to pretend that they control morality and that therefore they can have their way. But it's not law to say that if some ownership of something has become contentious, therefore it can be moved from someone to someone else. I don't understand what that is. I mean, we have unconscionability in equity, but that's very specific. So I think we've talked about this before, but the idea that somebody gives up all of their life to work on a farm on the promise that they're going to be given fa that farm, and then they aren't given that farm, that's unjust. So that's why you do it then. But the idea that any museum item belongs somewhere else because of feelings is not law. That's just completely irrational nonsense.
So let's have a look then in the last few minutes at what the British Museum say. They say that they legally acquired, Lord Elgin legally acquired the marbles with permission from the Ottoman authorities, which governed Greece at the time. And historical documents, including the translated Italian version of a Firman, suggest that Elgin had some form of legal consent to remove the marbles. They also talk about the legal claim statute of limitation. Legal claim Greece might have would have been barred by the statute of limitations, given that the marbles had been in Britain for over 2 centuries, with no legal action taken until much later. They also talk about the British Museum Act of 1963. Let's talk about that. Legally, the marbles are protected under the British Museum Act, which prohibits items from the basically getting rid of items from the collection. It was often cited to argue that the trustees have no legal authority to return the marbles without parliamentary intervention. Give me a couple of sentences on that.
Okay, so I agree that the marbles were obtained lawfully. I would always say lawfully, not legally, and that, I think that's a big difference between me and a lefty lawyer. If you find a lefty drafting, they tend to say legally, and I tend to say lawfully. And it's a very important point to note. They then raise the statute of limitations, which I think is really important. This is the idea that, and we raised it in the Chagos Islands, even the family division recognizes that after the passage of a certain amount of time, no, you're not allowed to reopen arguments. And the point of that is very simple. If you don't have that as a principle in your human society, humans will just keep arguing over everything. There's always an argument. People can always have one. So we have the idea of limitation of action quite seriously. And on the Elgin marbles, it's 6 years. So some time has passed.
I think that, and it's the other general point, isn't it, Stephen? As we say, it basically could set a precedent for other repatriation claims, and it could empty museums of significant non-native artifacts.
And it could put things at serious risk. The most important thing is to preserve artifacts for as long as possible. That, we all thought Syria was a very settled, developed democracy. What happened in Syria is an absolute tragedy. But a man gave his life defending an archaeological site in Syria called Palmyra, which was founded by a queen called Zenobia, who rebelled against Roman rule. And because of where they were on the trade route, she had enough money that she thought she could actually get away with rebelling against Rome. She couldn't. Just a top tip, no one can. But she thought she could. So she thought she'd be rich enough. Because of that richness, because of that wealth, Palmyra is incredibly impressive. It's often, I think it's called Rose Red City, Half as Old as Time, by one of our romantic poets. It's a beautiful, beautiful, stunning place. And a man gave his life to protect Palmyra once Syria had fallen to Islamic Jihad. And they've seriously damaged Palmyra. I mean, I would kill them for that, to be honest. And so preserving artifacts, to my mind, is much more important than where they are.
Yeah, and as you said, if they hadn't been moved, and this is what the British Museum say, look, they would have disintegrated. They've done a good job looking after them, is what they would argue. So in summary, the legal arguments, they revolve around the interpretation of historical permissions. We've touched on that. The evolution of international law regarding cultural heritage, we've touched on that. And the constraint, thank you, two fingers you're waving in the air. Sounds good on the radio. And the constraints of British domestic law, complicated by moral and cultural dimensions that often involve legal discourse or influence. Legal discourse. Finally, then, Stephen, the last 10 seconds, what would be the resolution? How can we solve this? And is Starmer likely to give the whole thing away?
There is no resolution to this. I didn't talk about the Act, which constrains the trustees. I will have to at some point.
Well, talk about it now. Go for it.
Basically, we passed the Act because we didn't trust the trustees.
No
So
trust in the trustees.
we didn't trust the trustees. We have been through all of this before. There was a great deal of leftiness going around in the 60s. We were terribly worried that the trustees would become lefties and give loads of stuff away, particularly the Elgin Marbles. So the specific Act of Parliament was made, I think ironically by a left-wing government, but to stop them doing anything absolutely bonkers. They think, Andrew, and this probably is the breaking news point, the point that no one else could say, they think they found a way round it.
Oh, what is it? Go for it.
They think that if they declare that the Marbles are going on an extended loan,
Ah.
that will get around the Act because they're not giving them away,
Oh, I
they're just
see.
lending them
For
for an
like several
extended
centuries or
period.
something.
Well, we'll never get them back, so
But of course you won't. They'll come up with the same
exactly.
arguments.
So I am just waiting in the wings for one of them to pipe up on BBC News and say, "We found a way around giving away. What we will do is give them on an extended
Yeah, no, of
cultural
course.
loan."
Well, it's not a gift then, is it? Well, I suppose it's a gift. You can gift property for a period of time. That's still a gift.
What it's called is a sham.
Yes.
That's the legal term, and that's what I'll say, and I'll go on the telly to point out, dear trustee of the British Museum. So I don't care if it's George Osborne. I don't
What I
care if it's
always used
Mary
to
Beard.
love is, I think it was Benjamin, was it Benjamin Franklin or what, one of the great American presidents, I think at some stage, he used to say, if you call the tail of a dog a leg, how many legs does a dog have?
It's Abe Lincoln.
That's the one it was. I always say Abe Lincoln. It was Abe Lincoln. I always get that. I don't think I've got that sort of. So Abe Lincoln, obviously Disraeli was our side, but Abe Lincoln, he said exactly that. If you turn around and say, call the tail of a dog a leg, how many legs does a dog have? Well, Abe Lincoln used to keep people amused at dinner parties all the time when they said, oh, five. And he said, no. It's still four. Just because you call a tail a leg doesn't make it so. So I would work on the same basis that Abe Lincoln's gag has to apply to a gift, doesn't it?
It does, and we're going to have to at some we you and I'll have to do a whole episode on the law of sham if they
The
try
law of
that.
sham, the
And it's there,
LOS.
it's in equity, it's perfectly normal. I can explain sham, I can cite case law. If they go down this path of thinking that they're so clever they can somehow get behind the 1964 Act, which, by the way, people have been trying to get behind it for ages. So if everybody else has failed to get around the 1964 Act, you probably have too, love. But yeah,
Yeah.
if they think that they're getting so clever with their extended cultural loan
No,
that they can
it
beat it.
sounds good. Well, we're gonna haul them over. We'll refer them to this episode. But for now, Stephen, as we always say, you can follow Stephen on his brilliant Substack. You can follow me at Andrew Ebel and at Octopus TV. I'm on Substack as well somewhere if you want to go and boost that up. But also follow me on YouTube. It'd be lovely to join that glorious community. Click that love button now. It's basically you can subscribe to the Andrew Ebel Show on Octopus TV. More platforms than Paddington. As always, if you've got any topics you want Stephen and myself to unpack, if you'd like us to unpack anything at all, do get in touch. It's great to have your feedback. We really appreciate it. But for me, and for now, Stephen, thank you very much for joining us.